We have several bills up for hearing and possible work session this morning. The first bill up is HB 3287. I'll ask council to summarize it and call us into public hearing on HB 3287.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will summarize the bill. I will first note for the committee that there is one amendment on this bill that was provided to the committee last week. It was distributed. I will also note for the committee that I'm informed there are some trademark counterfeit goods on the table back there for the committee's perusal, and there are some things, as I understand, like a fake Rolex, and I would remind the committee that theft is still a crime in this state.
Well, but a fake stuff, don't you get a fake sentence?
Well, that's what we're dealing with this morning.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, what this bill does is to create three separate crimes, trademark counterfeiting in the first, second, and third degree, and trademark counterfeiting for all three is defined in the bill, and it is that occurs in the bill without the amendments if a person without the consent of the registrant sells a counterfeit of a mark registered under either the federal law or under the state law. What the amendments do is to redefine that just a little bit and add a mental state of knowingly and with the intent to sell or distribute, and then expands the scope of the crime beyond simply selling the mark to using, displaying, advertising, distributing, offering for sale, selling or possessing any item, all with the requirement that that is knowingly and with the intent to sell or distribute. The differences between the first, second, and third degree of trademark counterfeiting have to do with the volume and the value, and I'm sure that the witnesses can go into that in more detail.
And colleagues, we have Dash 1 amendments that were distributed as of March 22. Are there any other amendments?
Those are the only ones that I've been provided, Mr. Chairman.
I should also note for the record that I've received a letter from Michael Strunk, the district attorney for Multnomah County, extending his support for this bill with the proposed amendments. And his point is that existing case law does not adequately address the need for trademark protection. And he notes that it's important both for the manufacturer and the consumer that product identification relate to expected product quality. His letter was faxed to me at my law firm over the weekend, so I don't anticipate it got here, but it may have, another copy has been provided. We'll enter that into the record. And our first person up is the sponsor of the bill, Representative Strobeck. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Mannix and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ken Strobeck, State Representative from District 6 in Beaverton, Iowa, home of Nike Incorporated, which is in my district. I'm bringing you this bill and was asked to sponsor it, and after I learned some details about the issue, was a very enthusiastic sponsor of this bill. I'll talk for a moment and then turn the program over to Paul Phillips and members of the International Anti-Counterfeiting Coalition, as well as some industry representatives from here in Oregon who can describe the problem in detail and why this bill is necessary.
Ask one question at the outset.
Sure.
We do have a Dash 1 amendment. Are there going to be any other amendments presented?
I'm not aware of any other requested amendments.
Thank
beyond
you.
The Dash 1s.
I'm getting a no back there from the audience. Go ahead, please.
All right, thank you. Intellectual property, as we know, is very important. It's an issue of international as well as national contention, especially when we're talking about software and the product identity associated with particular trademarks. And we need to be sure that we treat this with the same kind of seriousness as Oregon is growing into this field as we do with actual physical property. Secondly, you may wonder why this is becoming a state issue. It was a question that I asked because I've always thought of this more as a federal, international kind of an issue. But the answer to that is that, and the other witnesses will get into this in more detail, but the threshold for enforcement of this is so high at the federal level that it takes usually $1 million or more threshold before they ever get involved in it. And secondly, with the technology to produce counterfeit goods has developed so rapidly that it's easier for someone to set up shop and start selling counterfeit goods and then do that all in state rather than crossing interstate lines. So then you have the issue of that being a potential crime within the state and not just an interstate issue. And finally, this really is a consumer protection issue because when you buy something that has a particular trademark or label, you want to have the assurance that you're getting quality goods. And, you know, these companies have spent a lot of time and investment to make sure that their products are up to a certain standard. And then when people buy goods that are bogus, it often reflects poorly back on the true owner of the trademark who then gets a black eye for that kind of product. Also, I think it's really important to point out that Oregon is emerging as a national leader in several brands, and you'll see examples of that today. But, you know, of course, Nike is the largest and most famous one, but we also have Adidas based here, and Columbia Sportswear, which, you know, you watch any skiing or athletic event, you see pretty much everybody's got Columbia Sportswear now on their jackets, as well as, of course, the Portland Trailblazers. And all of those companies have been victims of counterfeit material. We also have a lot of major events that occur in the state, things at the Rose Festival, major sporting events, and those are potential hotbeds for people to create bogus goods and then sell them on an unsuspecting public. Both sides end up being the loser in that. So I encourage you to treat this bill positively, adopt the -1 amendments, and pass it favorably out of the committee, and I think we in Oregon will be better served for having that law. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Apparently we have no questions. Thank you, Representative Brasilbeck.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Paul Phillips, come on up. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm here representing members of the International Anti-Counterfeiting Coalition, predominantly today Nike, Columbia Sportswear, and Adidas. And for the record, my name is Paul Phillips with PacWest Communications. I have testimony here that I'm going to give to staff. Thanks, Patsy. Not to bury you with paperwork, Mr. Chair, both Council Horton and yourself have made my opening statements rather brief. We have one amendment that has been distributed. You have a letter from Mike Shrunk, which has been distributed. We have John Bliss in from out of town today, and Mr. Bliss, Dave Simpson, Michael Harbrunner from Adidas will testify right after me. The only additional thing I'd like to get on the record is that Carl Davis, VP and General Counsel for Columbia Sportswear Company, couldn't be here today. I've also introduced his testimony into the record for you. The last paragraph on the second page where he cites that they have successfully forced more than 50 companies from selling knockoffs of their apparel is a key paragraph, and he asks for you to pass this legislation on and help them in the future. With that, Mr. Chair, what I've asked my clients to do, Mr. Bliss, Dave Simpson, and Michael to come up together, not read their testimony, but take highlights of their testimony that has been passed out to you and be ready to answer any questions. Mr. Bliss has been traveling around the country, working in the other states that are also adopting this legislation, and those experiences may be of assistance to you. But in summary, we have one amendment. If that were adopted and moved on, we have not had anybody contact us with opposition to this measure, so I, from that perspective, I don't know of any other amendments that would be needed.
All right. Okay. We appreciate that, Mr. Phillips. You've also done a nice job of briefing members of the committee ahead of time, which helps speed the process. I'm going to ask at this time, I do not have anyone signed up in opposition to this bill. Mr. Rice, will you be testifying? Thank you. Jim Rice for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association will be testifying, and I'll sign you up, Mr. Rice. Is there anyone else that's here to testify who has not signed up on House Bill 3287? I don't see anybody raising their hands. We'll go ahead and invite up Dave Simpson and John Bliss and Michael, is it Heilbrunner? Heilbrunner. Please come up. Welcome to the committee. And what I'll ask you gentlemen to do is each of you speaks for the first time for our recording and record purposes. Please introduce yourself for the record. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Bliss. I'm the president of the International Anti-Counterfeiting Coalition. We are a not-for-profit trade association headquartered in Washington, and we're comprised of 180 companies, all of whom share a problem in that their products are counterfeited around the country. And I'm here today in support of HB 3287 because it is a necessary piece of legislation to ensure that the deterrent effect associated with engaging in counterfeiting is increased. What we're finding around the country, and this is now, we've passed 21 felony statutes in the last 5 years, I believe, on counterfeiting, and we're finding that counterfeiters simply gravitate to those states where it is a misdemeanor to engage in counterfeiting, and they stay away from the states where it is a felony. Currently, the states of Washington has a felony statute in its legislature this year, and our concern is in the absence of getting a counterfeiting statute at the felony level in Oregon, you will see an increased influx of counterfeits into your state.
I'll mention parenthetically that the one issue you probably do not have to address in depth is why have a state law when there's federal legislation. We've already had plenty of education this session about the lack of federal enforcement in other areas, such as in mail theft, where I guess today someone would have to steal a U.S. postal vehicle in order, full of mail, in order to have the federal government do something about mail theft. So we understand the threshold issue involving federal enforcement. I guess they're too busy encroaching in other areas of state concern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to just touch on three themes, and if I may, if I could have my written comments inserted into the record.
In fact, we will take all of these written remarks presented by all of you and present them into the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The three themes I wanted to try and get across to you today are, one, the increased incidence of organized crimes involvement in this area of crime. The second, the increased incidence of health and safety risks posed by those who produce counterfeit products for sale to the consuming public. And then lastly, the increased economic impact that we're seeing around the country at the local community level. I think all of us probably suspect that counterfeits are the type of problem that you find on the streets and in flea markets and small boutiques. But with the increased profit potential in this area of criminal activity, we're seeing a significant influx of organized criminal involvement. There is a gang, for example, in New York that I referred to in my testimony, the Boy and the Kill Gang, that has whose head reportedly amassed $14 million in personal profit selling Rolex and Cartier watches. He had a very chilling sales tactic. He simply approached mom-pa jewelers and said, if you don't buy my watches, I'll kill you. And he did, and he's now serving three consecutive life sentences for murder. So the kinds of people that are engaged in this activity are no longer the mom-pa selling and cutting labels onto shirts in back rooms. They're very sophisticated professional enterprises that are engaged in a number of other criminal activities, not the least of which is counterfeiting. And in fact, counterfeiting is becoming the sort of money laundering vehicle of choice for professional criminals to launder their drug money. The second point I wanted to raise with you is the increased health and safety risks. I've just brought a couple of examples. There are others over here on the table. Here we have Head & Shoulders shampoo, with the legitimate being in my left hand and the fake being in my right. This product was available in legitimate store shelves, Safeways around the country, and this company, Procter & Gamble, had to take the extraordinary step of issuing advertisements in newspapers around the country, I think 27, notifying everybody that if they bought the fake, they might result in getting some kind of infection if they had a weakened immune system. There is bacteria that they found, Listeria, in this product. The only way you could have told the difference is a slightly elongated neck, and even side by side, that's hard to see. Certainly, if you hadn't seen them side by side, you would never know the difference. And secondly, there is a recycle label on the legitimate one that all products have that the fake doesn't. The second product I wanted to share with you is baby formula. Believe it or not, counterfeiters are counterfeiting baby formula. The scam takes a variety of hues. Sometimes this product has active ingredient but which is expired, legitimate ingredient. Sometimes the material is soy-based when it should be milk-based. Sometimes it's just out-and-out fake. This company found out about the problem when a mother saw the powder had the wrong color, wrong consistency, and the measuring spoon was the wrong color. She ended up calling the toll-free hotline on the product, which the counterfeiters had included on the counterfeit label accurately, and the company determined that they had a very significant counterfeiting problem, and they still do around the country. And again, this counterfeit was available in legitimate stores. This was found in Safeway in 16 states. The problem that this presents, at least with this particular counterfeit activity, children who were ingesting this were getting rashes, and some were getting convulsions and seizures. And the concern that this company obviously has is this is the sole source of nutrition for babies. And if you're fed even out-of-date baby formula for a period of a month, you will lose a lot of needed nutrients. other products are over there, but I just wanted to leave you with this, which is sort of the significant issue that we see. Counterfeiters are simply unwilling to be constrained by morals. They will make money on whatever they can make money on. If it happens to be a high-selling baby formula, they'll do it there. If it's auto parts, they'll sell there. If it's sunglasses, they'll sell sunglasses. They're very opportunistic, whatever they can get their hands on. And lastly, it's obviously clear to you all that there are enormous profits that are being lost by the corporations that produce legitimate product. But what may be not so clear is the loss to the local economies. In New York, for example, in Manhattan, they estimate that they're losing $350 million a year in lost sales and excise taxes. Counterfeiters aren't in the business of paying taxes. They're a cash-only operation. What assets they have are secreted in foreign accounts. So by passing a criminal law, you increase the deterrent effect by imposing actual jail sentences, although they will be very slight. We estimate maybe a handful of arrests, and I think Dave is going to go into that. You will send the counterfeiters a message that they're not welcome in the state, and they will not counterfeit in your state with a felony statute. That's been our experience. Thank you very much.
Mr. Bliss, Representative Brzezinski, we have a question for you in a moment. I was going to mention, too, that we've had testimony already on another proposed crime, which is identity theft. And we've had testimony from individuals talking about the theft of their good name and how difficult it is then for them to recover their good name in terms of the credit market and everything else. It seems to me there's a parallel here with the theft of the good name of a company, which has to worry about product quality and the consciousness of the consumer about that product quality. So I see a parallel here.
That's a very good point, Mr. Chairman. One example comes to mind. You all recall in the early 70s, Izod shirts with the Lacoste and the alligator. I mean, you haven't seen any of those in a long time. That's because Izod, which is a foreign-based company, had no anti-counterfeiting enforcement program in the United States. And they ultimately had to declare bankruptcy in the United States because of their counterfeiting problem. And in the bankruptcy filings, they couldn't even declare as an asset their trademark. It had been so depleted as a result of counterfeiting.
Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bliss, I want to ask you a question, but I want to frame it as to let you know where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for Fulbright and Jaworski in Houston for 7 years as a legal assistant. One of the areas I was assigned to at one time was patents and utilities, and we took in a lot of trademark infringement stuff. And actually used to go into stores that we had Fortune 500 companies, Coca-Cola being one of them, and looking at a lot of products that had been, with their design script and stuff like that. So my concern is from reading the law as it would apply from my perspective also as a prosecutor, we're going to see more of the really low-end individuals that are going to be picked up in this.
Mm-hmm.
It seems kind of interesting to me that you bring to us today the health and risk and safety areas. I mean, to me, I'd be very surprised that the FDA and the Bureau are not involved in the Head and Shoulders,
mm-hmm.
The child formula type of foods. Is this not true?
Oh, the FDA Office of Criminal Investigation takes a very active role in policing the adulterated, misbranded, and counterfeit product. But they're very underfunded, undermanned. They have, I think, 6 investigators responsible for policing all of the country's product, and they simply are awash in their own responsibilities. A lot is, by their own account, they believe, is starting to seep through, and we absolutely need a state complement to the federal enforcement activities, in our view.
If I could follow through. I guess, and honing this in a little bit more, as the chair said, we've already had the identity theft before us, and what we learned through that committee hearings was that many of these individuals are not in our state.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question to you is, if less these people are actually in our state doing the manufacturing and the production in this state, isn't it true that we would not be able to touch them with this state law unless they're actually caught here in the state?
I might defer to Dave Simpson with Nike, who's a former law enforcement agent.
Well, I in fact use it as the entree for Mr. Simpson to speak and answer Representative Brzezinski's question as part of your presentation.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, Representative Brzezinski, it would depend certainly, as I'm sure you understand, the facts. If we found someone out of state and were able to get them within the state to sell, as we do in some of the federal cases that we've been involved in, where you have to establish venue, whether it be in the United States or be within the state of Oregon. We could certainly, if we were able to establish that someone outside the state sent product to someone within the state that was counterfeit, and we were able to establish that, we may seek an indictment for that person, because the criminal conduct would go across the state line then, because they are actually selling within the state, even though they themselves may not have come in the state. So there's a possibility you could get an in-state indictment in a situation like that.
If I could follow up, Mr. Simpson?
Yes, sir.
But the reality is, since you've done law enforcement work, you probably know that indictments, just because you get the indictment on paper, the very few times in this type of case, for the type of level of charge, it may be extremely difficult to be able to get someone to actually do some type of, let's say, reaching out with the long arm of the law to actually bring them into our jurisdiction.
Those are always difficulties and obstacles that anyone in law enforcement, as you have been, sir, are aware of, that budgets sometimes drive decisions. Yes, sir.
And if you could, maybe in your presentation, Mr. Simpson, also comment on Mr. Bliss's statement regarding that by passing this law, this would be some type of deterrent effect on crime. And my question really is, we already have a lot of stuff on the books at the federal level, which is much more severe than what's called for within here. And it doesn't seem to me that we're going to have any more of an effect on the individuals who are profiting $14 million, as we heard through the testimony, to be thinking they're going to succumb to some type of legal ramifications in our state, if they're not even in our state.
Well, we see this, if I may just kind of start at the beginning from my point of view, Mr. Chairman.
By the way, it's David W. Simpson.
David W. Simpson, yes, sir. And I'm with Nike. We look at these kinds of crimes as having three victims, really. The first being the consumer, who buys the adulterated product of some type, whatever it might be. The second is the business within the community, which we all service in one form or another here, who lose sales to these kinds of profiteers. And the third, of course, is a trademark or patent holder or whoever it might be. In enforcing these kinds of laws, we have found that having not only federal legislation, but also state legislation that a local district attorney and a local police department can refer to and use to assist them in quelling this kind of conduct ahead of time, and or approaching an individual who may get involved in this and say, listen, this is against the law, we're going to have to deal with it, we find that we see it go away a little bit faster than when you local police officer says, you know, this is a federal crime, I'm going to call the FBI. You know, the bad guy knows that's not really going to amount to much. In this situation, if they tell and attempt to enforce a state law, the likelihood of getting some enforcement seems to me to be a better way to go. Complementing, if you have the large violator, and then you may want to go to the federal level. It just depends on the quantity of goods involved. I would estimate in this state, as indicated in my testimony, the biggest offenders we see here, frankly, are flea markets. Both state and county fairs have had problems, and some street corner sales. I would estimate that we would get over 10 prosecutions a year in the entire state. I'd be very surprised if it got beyond that. It very well could if we didn't have this kind of legislation, because as Mr. Bliss pointed out, the manufacturers of these kinds of goods seem to gravitate to places where the law is a little weak and where the enforcement isn't very strong.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Simpson, the testimony that we've heard so far this morning talks about really the high-level, multi-billion dollar organization.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess my concern is, looking at this bill, the people that you're going to be able to capture under this bill is more the low level, the kid that's making 20 copies of the movie when they go to the movie theater and selling it at the flea market, the Nike t-shirts that you can get almost anywhere. So I guess my concern is, based on the testimony, we're talking about a very organized activity But the reality is the people that are going to be impacted by this law are going to be people that aren't part of a big corporation, but very low-level street people that are is just as illegal, but it is as different as night and day, the level that you're talking about.
That's true, Representative Bowman. Mr. Chairman, what we have done in other areas where we've done enforcement is we attack at all levels. We use the low-level person, and what we try and do, quite frankly, is turn them around, find out where they got the goods, and go back up the chain, much like any criminal enterprise that's multi-layered, to capture the manufacturer or distributor. Most of the apparel that we see in the United States is manufactured within the United States. This is not imported goods. This is goods that are manufactured here in the United States and distributed in a variety of methods throughout the country. If we were to make and approach the person that you're concerned about, we would certainly want to then find out where they got the goods, who they got them from, and if we could elicit their cooperation, then work ourselves backwards that way. That's the kind of investigations that we have sponsored and what we've seen with law enforcement throughout the country is, you know, multifaceted approach.
In fact, you have a tiered approach here to your to the level of activity and to the charge, moving from Class A misdemeanor to Class C felony to Class B felony. And I noticed that you also have a special sanction capability for the Class A misdemeanor, that if the defendant is a corporation, the maximum fine can be $100,000 despite the usual limitations for a Class A misdemeanor.
Sure.
So it appears that you're working your way up in terms of level of enforcement, in terms of level of sanction. Russell Bowman, did you have another question?
I did have a follow-up, Mr. Chair. But I think I lost it while you were talking.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Simpson, go ahead then.
Mr. Chairman, if I just may respond to Representative Bowman's question, it's neither in the manufacturer's interest to incarcerate the low-level vendor, just as much as it's not in the prosecutor's interest to incarcerate the low-level vendor. Both interests are intent upon trying to get those people to turn in the high-level guy. The prosecutor, in the exercise of his prosecutorial discretion, is not going to spend a lot of money and time trying to put in jail the vendor. He is going to spend some time and money trying to get that person to cooperate with him so that he can put in jail the manufacturer of the goods. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Simpson, did you have further remarks you wanted to offer?
The only other thing I want to bring out is part of my testimony on page 2 of the letter that I sent to a federal probation officer in North Carolina, I believe it is, talks about the values and the numbers of dollars lost, not only to the trademark holder, but to the various businesses around the country that deal in name brand sporting goods in our case. In this particular case, a manufacturer down there was charged and had 190,000 three-pair packs of socks with a wholesale value of just under $1 million and a retail value of $1.9 million. This gives you an idea of the volume of goods and the amounts of dollars involved that are lost revenue, not only to the trademark holders, but to the various government agencies wherein this business is carried on.
Mr. Chair, if I may. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Simpson, you just made me think of something else. A counterfeit product obviously has less value than the real product. So when you say the value is less than $1,000, are you assuming that it would be based on what the real product would sell at, or is it what the counterfeit product will bring in?
The way we have approached that is what the counterfeit product would be selling for. Otherwise, you could really create a difficult time trying to say that the counterfeit product, as you say, the $3 for $5 T-shirt is in fact the same value as a Nike T-shirt. It simply isn't. And so the approach we have taken and urged is that it be the value of whatever it is they're selling.
One last follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mr. Simpson, I guess I'm still troubled by the process. So let's say, for example, I have a operation in my garage making Nike T-shirts. I know it makes you cringe, but let's just for the sake of argument. I don't personally sell the T-shirts. I hire young people to sell the T-shirts at sporting events and other activities. tell me what the process would be from that young person at the Blazer game who's trying to sell these T-shirts for me. How do you get back actually to me? And who's the one that actually goes to jail and forfeits their property and stuff?
Very typically in a situation like that, Bowman, we would work backwards just like any criminal enterprise. If a police officer or a private investigator were to discover someone selling T-shirts of that nature, they had a small quantity, you would find out where they got the shirts and then work backwards, hopefully with their cooperation, work backwards. As I'm sure everyone who's been involved in any kind of matters of this nature, in order to elicit and get the cooperation of these individuals, sometimes you need to have a stick a little bit. And the misdemeanor charge that would perhaps go with what they were doing would be that potential stick. Say, hey, we need your cooperation. What you're doing is against the law, but we need, you know, we know you're just a kid out here selling bad stuff. Where'd you get the stuff? And then work backwards from them to the distributors and potentially to the manufacturer.
Thank you. Mr. Heilbrunner?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representatives of the committee, my name is Michael Heilbrunner. I am Associate Counsel of Adidas America, Inc., which is based in Beaverton, Oregon. And I'm here to testify as well on behalf of House Bill 3287. I would, rather than reiterate some of the points made by Mr. Bliss and Mr. Simpson, I'd like to focus on the preventative nature of this measure, and that counterfeiting is a type of crime that can't work without some of these lower-level people, and what we're trying to do here is prevent a situation that is not bad now from becoming as bad as some of the situations described by Mr. Bliss in New York and California is another state where the problem is proliferated to the point that it's very difficult to get at it from the lower levels, and you're operating at the networks that they described are operating at very high levels. One of the things that we would hope to do with this kind of bill is show people that might operate at the lower levels that this is going to be taken seriously and hopefully prevent the situation from just increasing and feeding on itself to becoming something that's a big problem that needs to be addressed later on with similar kind of legislation that would occur after the fact rather than before the fact.
You want to close the barn door before the horse gets out.
Effectively, yes. And that the kind of networks that have been described here really cannot operate without lower-level operatives who right now aren't a major problem, and we don't want to see it become a huge problem in the future, as it has in other states.
So one of the intentions here is that the word on the street ought to be that this has now become illegal in Oregon, so watch your back, Jack.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, just made one more thing. In these plastic bags are items I asked an investigator in Portland to go out about 2 months ago at one of the flea markets and purchase, and what we have here is a counterfeit Tommy Hilfiger, Nike, and Adidas shirt, and some counterfeit jewelry that was purchased in Portland since the first of the year. Also, I'd like to point out roles of labels. Label manufacturing, this is what the counterfeiters will do, and not just make the garment, but they counterfeit the labels to insert in the garments. They counterfeit sunglasses. It will say not only the name brand on it, but it will say UV protection, which they typically are not. Packaging, the whole nine yards. I mean, everything that we do to make a product look good, the counterfeiters will do to try and sell their products also.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Simpson, of all these items that you've just shown to us, can you tell us how many of those were actually manufactured or produced here in the state?
In the state? No, sir, I cannot. I would guess probably very few, to be honest with you. I think most of the manufacturing, on apparel at least, is done in Los Angeles for the West Coast distribution. There is some manufacturing that goes on in Seattle, we've discovered. Most of the sunglasses, for example, will be brought into this country blank, and by that I mean they don't have any trademark on them, and then they'll do the packaging and put the decals or whatever it is they're doing to the sunglass on them in the United States and then distribute them throughout the states. Same thing with the labels. Many times they're manufactured domestically, but many times they're brought in also.
Representative Kuznanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Simpson, I think I just want to close as to the comment that you made earlier as to the number of people that you expect that may be caught up in this in our state for prosecution being about 10. If I heard you correctly, and you felt that those were going to be people at the street corner in the flea market arenas, it seems to me that we're back to square one, that we're talking about only being able to impact the person at the street level, the ones that actually are selling these to the public in these venues. And it only seems, from my experience in prosecution, as well as hearing people and other testimony and different hearings that we've heard this year, that even if local police get this information, their own resources is not going to allow them to carry on any lengthy investigation, specifically when it shows that the core of the problem is outside of the state.
Well, what we do, Mr. Chairman, Representative Frasansky, in many cases, we have investigators around the country that we use that work with law enforcement. Many times the information that we may develop in one of the smaller states like Oregon or some of the other states that don't have a huge manufacturing problem, we will use that to go back and to cause enforcement someplace else. But in order to get to that first step in those smaller states such as ours, we need to have laws like this to get the police and or the sheriff or whomever to take that initial step. So we will, you know, cooperatively work with the police and whomever to try and ensure that we do go after the manufacturer, which you're concerned about, sir.
Thank you.
We might describe that as the silver platter process. You bring the prosecutor or the police the case on a silver platter and say, here's all the information that I've gathered. We'd appreciate it if you'd consider proceeding with it, and hand it to them on a silver platter and see whether or not they decide that they want to partake.
Representative, Mr. Chairman, in many cases that's exactly what we do by hiring private investigators. As you can see, Adidas and Nike were fiercely competitive in the marketplace, but we work also represented back on this table are Tommy Hilfiger, FUBU, Nautica, Walt Disney, Warner Brothers, all of these name brands in this area, we work together cooperatively. There's my counterpart at all these companies, and if we find something going on, it typically involves all or most of us, and we will work together to try and solve that problem, whether it involves a huge number of Nike or a huge number of some other brand.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to let Mr. Bliss respond, then I'll get back to Representative Prozanski and Representative Ballman.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond to Representative Prozanski's question? I think, conceitedly, there's less of a problem in the state now than there might otherwise be in the absence of this statute. And as Mr. Heilbronner said, what we're trying to do is prevent the problem from growing. Some people describe this as the water balloon theory of criminal enforcement, where if you push the water balloon in here, it pops out over here. And there's anecdotal evidence to suggest that in the absence of a statute here, you will see an influx of counterfeiting activity, and you will see manufacturing bases spring up and distributorships spring up. I'll give you an example of New York. In New York, at one point, there wasn't a felony statute, and there was a significant amount of counterfeiting occurring there. There still is, even with the felony statute. But with the passage of the felony statute in New York, it caused a migration of counterfeiters to the contiguous states around New York, to New Jersey, to Delaware, to Pennsylvania. And our fear is that you're now getting a felony statute that will be passed in Washington. You will see a migration to misdemeanor statute states, and what we're trying to do is ward that, head that off at the pass.
So you're the immunization team.
In effect.
Professor Prozanski, you had another question.
Thank you. I guess just a comment to that. I mean, the areas that we're talking about where the production is really going on, I think we all would agree, is where you have all the apparels and textiles industries really meshed in together. And it sounds like now maybe they're starting to branch out a little bit. I guess the one question, I'm not sure if the panel's the correct place to ask this or not, but looking at the bill, it does provide that this would also go into the Oregon RICO statutes. And I'm wondering if you want to comment as to why you think it should be put in the RICO statutes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Prozanski, I'll have Dave follow up. But in essence, counterfeiters are fearful of two things. They're fearful of going to jail, and they're fearful of having their assets seized. The assets being the equipment and material used to engage in the counterfeiting activity, the vans used to transport them. That, if you're part of a forfeiture statute, you have significant deterrent effect in warding off this criminal activity. Frankly, the civil penalties are more cost of doing business. Counterfeiters will literally laugh in court at the prospect of being fined for engaging in counterfeiting because they make 10 times more than the civil penalty on any given day, just in the sale of one day's goods. We're talking about profits that equal drug profits. You can make more selling Oakley sunglasses in one day than you can selling crack cocaine. And that is why counterfeiters are doing what they're doing, and they're less, and they're moving from drugs. Less risk of incarceration, equal high profits.
One more for us, Mr. Vance.
Thank you. So, in other words, based on what we've heard so far of the 10 people that may be caught up in the statute being the street-level person, we're talking about potentially using the RICO statutes to take potentially their cars because they use the car to go from home where they may have a box that they got from some outside, out-of-the-state interest to bring the property down to the street corner or the flea market they sold. And so are we going to be looking at taking those type of means because it was used to facilitate that crime by moving the T-shirts from point A to point B?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brzezinski, it would seem to me that the prosecutors in the various counties within the state of Oregon and their judgment in how this would apply and when this would apply would hopefully address those kinds of concerns. I don't foresee, nor have I seen in the experience that I've had around the country where this kind of law does exist, where the end seller that you're speaking of, which I think is what we would find here for the most part, is going to be suffering any kind of loss like that. What we do see from time to time, the people in these state fairs that run these kinds of circuits, is that's really their business. I mean, they will drive to L.A. in their van and pick up the loads of counterfeit goods and bring them back, and either they will distribute themselves and or sometimes they're involved in the sales themselves. They cut out the distributor by going right to the source themselves. So there would be potential, but I think good judgment would prevail, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to defer to Representative Hansen. He's been trying desperately to get your attention.
Not terribly desperate. First comment, I thought Representative Bowman's hypothetical situation had a great deal of detail in it for something that was just spur of the moment. I think I had similar concerns in terms of concern that a small T-shirt operator working on the coast that maybe somebody came along and sold them some apparel items out of the back of their car would get caught up in this. But I think, one, the amendment helps a great deal in terms of my comfort level with stressing the knowingly.
That's right. That's right. It's a big
key. You know, if you're either a small businessman or even a kid, if somebody comes, if you were approached and somebody gave you a story that said, yeah, this is surplus goods or we picked it up from a bankruptcy sale or something like that, I think it would be relatively difficult to prove knowingly that they'd virtually have to confess that they, or if there was a sleeve missing on all 100 copies. But the knowingly raises my comfort level a great deal in the amendment. And it's a serious crime and a serious impact on our economy, especially when we've got some major corporations. Adidas is moving to North Portland from Beaverton, hopefully soon. That overall impact can hurt jobs in the state and can really cause us to have it's sort of a silent, hidden economic deterrent. And I think if this adjusts it, and the people that are basically making their living, even at the street level, if they're basically making their living, knowing that they're engaging in something that's, one, illegal and something that isn't honest, I think we can address that. And if that means losing a van that they've used to transport this, the person that just kind of occasionally that owns a T-shirt shop and has one or two items that they stumbled across, it, that's, I don't see that as a big deal. But somebody that would fill their whole shop with that type of material, I think we'd want to close down completely.
We might add that someone who's willing to counterfeit or distribute counterfeit goods is probably also unlikely to follow the employment and labor laws and tax laws of the state. So there's a lot of other harms, including the people who end up not getting paid when they thought they were going to get paid for doing their work. Mr. Bliss?
Mr. Chairman, on that point, there are a number of sweatshop violations that occur in connection with the manufacture of counterfeit items. And responding again to Representative Bowman's concern and Mr. Hansen's point about knowledge, this may help you in that not only do you have a knowledge test, but to prove knowledge as a matter of practical reality, there's sort of a one bite at the apple that these guys get. You go to them and you say, I have knowledge that you've been engaging in the sale of counterfeits. You've now put that person on notice. You've proven to them that you have an expert, say Mr. Heibronner from Adidas, saying, yes, this is a fake. You've been selling it. So they get off generally the first time, but the second time now they're on constructive knowledge. So it's not only a knowledge test, but you've actually approached them with the problem.
Mr. Chair, if I may follow up. I do believe that this legislation is necessary, but my concern is the way this legislation is written, the chance of the most serious crimes are for the lowest level of people who are involved in this enterprise. And, I mean, if you're talking about the kid on the street, that's the one who's going to get arrested. That's the one that will have a conviction on their record. And so the second time you catch that kid on the street, now you've got the possibility of sending them to jail as a felon. But you're no closer to getting the person that's got this company who's manufacturing these products and distributing it to people to sell on the street level. And so that's where I'm having a real problem with this legislation. I mean, if the goal is to get the person who's actually infringing on the trademark, and the reality is the only people who are going to be impacted are the people who are on the street level selling the product, then is this the appropriate legislation to be moving forward?
If I may respond,
wrap up your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bowman, I think that the first-time offender is either going to receive a warning or potentially, given the volume that they may have, certainly could get arrested. As Mr. Bliss pointed out, that creates the knowledge, you know, the knowingly sell, blah, 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 whatever it might be, is the key to this kind of legislation and to this kind of enforcement. If the person continues in that kind of conduct, yes, they may get arrested again and again and again. That certainly could happen if they continue. Hopefully, that wouldn't be the case. Hopefully that person, that young person would learn. Most of what we see in the person on the street selling is a person who has acquired a fairly large quantity of counterfeit goods someplace and has a van and sets up on a street corner and hangs them, you know, much like you do some of the street corner vendors you see around the state. So the quantities are pretty great as opposed to somebody standing, you know, with two or three T-shirts. We just frankly don't see that at all. The only time I've ever seen that kind of an issue is usually at concerts, things of that nature, and frequently the concert promoters get a special federal order dealing with that, and the enforcement that goes on there is just a strict seizure where they take the goods from the person's home. They can't do it.
Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your coming to testify this morning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Rice, good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, members of the committee. Chairman Mannix, Jim Rice, and the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm kind of torn here this morning because on the one hand, you know, I'd hate to buy a bad pair of sneakers as much as the next person, and I'm also quite pro-business. And on the other hand, I'm against welfare in general and also against the criminalization of so many things that we see here. I was thinking about Representative Simmons' bill I've done a lot of thinking about it, about the people selling alcohol at a state, you know, how could we get at those people? And it kind of ties in with this, because what I was thinking is, what government should do more is mimic private business. Privatize it and let them go after those people by doing things like looking what Microsoft does. When someone's pirating, I read about stuff in the Wall Street Journal at night, and it really kind of helps me. And what Microsoft does is they send strike forces in, and they go in there and they find out someone's pirating their stuff down in Los Angeles. They've got private lawyers, and they got laptop computers, and they got legal assistants, and they go running down there into federal court, and they use injunctive remedy, things that happen very quickly, temporary restraining orders and injunctions, and they slap it on those people, and they seize those people. And, you know, I admire that, people taking care of their own problems in business, especially when we're dealing with billionaires. I like that, billionaires taking care of their own problems. So I'm sitting back here today, and I'm listening to these billionaires, and also on Friday night, I might add, I was reading the Wall Street Journal had a special supplement on how much chief executive officers of American corporations make. They really make a lot of dough. So we've got people who are doing very well. They're putting out a good product, selling it worldwide. I mean, we're the leaders in this stuff. But now they want our district attorneys and our police officers to investigate their problems when they actually have some pretty decent remedies. And you can see the smart lawyers they have. And Mr. Simpson, I think, was a Portland police officer at one time. I still remember seeing him on television. And I'm wondering here, and I sit here sometimes, and it's hard. Kids who, you know, can't get alcohol treatment, runaways, you listen to this stuff and you say, you know, we got terrible problems in this state, and it's money-based, and it's sad, it really is. And then I hear people who come in and, you know, I wouldn't want to buy a bad Rolex watch, but why don't we let them take care of their own business? Why? I don't want wealth. I think welfare is actually a pretty bad idea for most folks. I think it gives people the wrong message. And I'm talking about poor people who are out there. They ought to get educated and turn their lives around and get to work and not rely on the government. And by the same token, if I expect that of our poorest citizens, our uneducated citizens, our handicapped citizens, I don't think I expect anything less from the smartest, the people who can hire Harvard, doesn't matter what. They've got the money to do whatever they need to do. And I admire them, and I hold them up here. But when I see them coming in asking for our scarce tax dollars for somebody selling T-shirts on a corner, I think we ought to just stop and just stop for 1 minute and say, I don't approve of that conduct, mind you, but I think they're capable of taking care of their own problems. And I just throw that out in the mix of things. And unless anybody has any questions, I'll go.
Thank you, Mr. Rice.
How far?
Is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 3287? Seeing no further testimony, the public hearing is closed. We'll go into work session on House Bill 3287. Colleagues, we have the bill in front of us. It's open for discussion, for a possible amendment, or for whatever.
Chair, I would move the dash ones into House Bill 3287.
Representative Cesari moves adoption of the dash one amendments to House Bill 3287. Discussion on the motion. Is there any objection to adoption of the motion? Seeing no objection, the dash one amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3287 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cesari moves House Bill 3287 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Discussion.
Mr. Chair,
do you want to speak to your motion? All right, Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've expressed my concerns during the public testimony. The testimony we heard talked about getting people who are, in fact, creating these trademark violations. Unfortunately, the legislation in front of us really doesn't deal with that class of people, in my opinion. I mean, there are some penalties, like losing all their stuff and records and computers, if they ever get to that class of person. But I have real concerns about how this will be implemented. The testimony said we can depend on the district attorneys to appropriately charge and make sure that this is used appropriately. I don't know that we have enough information to
assume that district attorneys are going to be able to use this appropriately. So I have some real concerns with moving forward on this legislation. And since we're moving it today, I guess I will have to be a no vote.
All right. Representative Sinceri?
Well, I thought about that myself, but I really think that you get into this kind of business, whether they're selling drugs or selling counterfeit, these people are down the streets know that they are the front people, and they have a higher profile, and they have a greater risk when they agree to do this kind of thing. I think that what this legislation will allow is that those people can maybe bargain for what kind of charge they get for giving up the people. And that's been a tradition, and it works. And I think whatever it was that Mr. Rice was trying to tell us, I don't know. I can't imagine an $800 attorney getting a restraining order and going down and serving it on a little teenager who's got a cardboard table full of T-shirts. But I think that regardless of what degree of success a corporation has, they deserve the full protection of the law. And that is one of the primary purposes of our civil government.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I need to put on the record, I'm going to be voting no at this time. I may change my vote at the time we go to the floor. I'm doing it for two reasons at this point. I really think that the people that are going to be caught up in this net are the small-time offenders, and that we could, in fact, take existing law and modify it to make certain that we get these individuals. Because I understand on the theft statutes and others that it doesn't really go to somebody who's actually using or selling product that they're not licensed to do. I think there's a way that we could do that. My biggest concern, I think, after going through all this, and I want to put some things on the record, and from my perspective of working and doing this type of work in Houston, Texas, is that really we're talking about a lack of a federal system. Here's another time where the federal government, who has exclusively been doing this, they're not doing their job. Mm-hmm. And now we as a state are being forced to deal with these issues. And I don't think it's appropriate because we have the laws that are on the books, and what Mr. Rice is talking about is exactly what Fulbright and Jaworski did for, in this particular case, Coca-Cola. We would go in, or they would go in to wherever the problem was, and they would get the injunctive relief, and it would take care of it. And so on the civil side, there's a way of dealing with it, and clearly, if this is something that we're not, if I'm surprised that the legislation is before us. I can understand maybe with Nike and Adidas being in the state, that they feel that they need to start positioning themselves. But the reality, we're just a blip, at that, on the radar screen as it comes to this type of conduct. And the vast majority of people that are producing this stuff, as the testimony showed, are not in the state. In fact, we had no examples of them being in the state. We're getting the final product before it goes to a consumer. And I would tell you that in probably most cases, in my work in Houston as well, what I've seen up here and just talking to people on the street corners that have these items, you can tell by the price they're charging that you're not getting the real thing.
Right.
And so, to me, I'm going to be voting no at this time, reserving the right to change my vote, and will be more than glad to talk to any of the individuals that are here today or their representatives that are representing them here through the legislative process before we go to the floor.
Thank you. Representative Hansen?
Well, I'll be supporting the passage of this. One, I'm still very offended over the fact that the $18 Rolex that I got my wife for her anniversary didn't work well. But I know I'm kind of balancing this on a couple of things, and I respect the concerns of two of my colleagues that I hope there's not a lot of small-scale corner people pick up with this. On the other hand, from my experience with Multnomah County, I don't think Multnomah County has the resources or the will to really go after them. Our district attorney is relatively underfunded. The court systems are relatively underfunded. I don't see this becoming a high priority of local officials unless they're really prompted by a private industry initiative, that if private industry goes out and virtually makes the cases for them, then I think we might see some prosecution. But then I would think it'd be very rare. What I would hope is that if this is used in the state, that it might be used by a buyer for a retail chain
that is buying, that should know better. Thinking of the Safeway example with the infant formula, somebody knowledgeable purchased that material without doing their job and potentially created a great deal of harm. The other concern that I have is that although we don't have a large textile industry, a lot of the counterfeiting, we don't have the type of base that would make that activity come into Oregon. But certainly we've got the base that it could be a huge problem in software development. There may be industries, new emerging industries in Oregon, where there is the spin-off of talent and manufacturing capacity that this could become like a cottage industry of the high-tech boom. And I think we should take some steps to prevent that. And again, I see this as primarily preventive medicine, but I don't think we're going to see a lot of the horror stories of the small people getting trapped up unless they're really, really doing it repeatedly and are becoming a real source of problems for someone.
Thank you. Representative Gianella.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to vote yes because if there's a crackdown in Washington and other states and it just causes more counterfeiting to come to Oregon, that would be a reason right there to vote yes on this bill. So I'll be voting yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's a good question, Mr. Chair.
You're the only one left.
Wow.
Now, the Chair has a few remarks to offer, and then we'll get to a vote on this. I basically look at this, counterfeit's a nice word for cheating, and I look at it as to what would I say to my kid if I was talking about this operation. This is a bunch of people who cheat other people. They cheat other people when they manufacture the goods. They cheat other people when they distribute the goods. They cheat other people at retail. And what would I say to my daughter if she bought something with the Mickey Mouse logo on it and I found out it was shoddy merchandise, then I found out it truly wasn't produced under license from Walt Disney Enterprises? I'd be explaining to her that these are some people, whoever did this, that are cheating other people, and that cheating is morally wrong. And the question then is, you're not only cheating, but you're cheating with a profit motive. Is the federal system enough? We've seen a number of areas we've talked about in the past where the federal government has found it, we think, unnecessary for them to get into state law enforcement issues. I usually look at the issue from the state perspective. Is this something good for the state to do, regardless of whether the federal government does it? And the answer to me in this case is yes. If there were no federal laws on this, I would do this. And if there are federal laws, I would still do this because I would want to see enforcement at the state level, regardless of what the federal government does. As to whether or not we should simply proceed with the civil enforcement side of things, one could run amok with that issue because I've pointed out in the past that in some states you can still have private attorneys general and private district attorneys who bring cases. And when I mentioned this to some members of this committee, they were just amazed. I don't think we want to move in the direction in this state of authorizing private enforcement on the criminal side. And then on the civil side, it's apparent that some of these cheaters will only respond ultimately to criminal sanctions. And if that's what it takes, that's what it takes. There may be some prevention that comes from this, particularly if we are sandwiched between states that are beginning to take effective action. And that is something to consider about, to think about. The old concept of caveat emptor, which is Latin for let the buyer beware, is no longer really used in consumerism. And we expect to some extent that government will regulate the trade and commerce so that consumers have some reasonable expectation that the product that they're buying is as advertised. And in fact, on the other side of the coin, we have severe product liability laws for manufacturers who don't come through as promised. I think part of our social obligation on the other side of that is to assist those who legally produce products to defend the quality of their goods. As to the prosecutor's use of resources, the question is always going to be there. I prefer to have the tool in the toolbox, knowing it's there to be used when it's needed, and not find out when I do need it that it's not there and hope that someday we'll put the tool in that toolbox. We have that issue come up every time we deal with criminal law enforcement. We always have to think about it. I also think that an issue that was only touched upon still needs to be discussed. We need to strengthen and support those who legitimately engage in commerce in our society. We want them to follow our labor and employment laws. We want them to honor the collective bargaining process. And yet these people, these counterfeiters, these cheats, they don't honor any employment laws. They don't honor the tax laws. They don't honor the labor laws. They're running against the entire system of legitimate workers. They basically can get away with screwing their workers because they're screwing the consumers and they're screwing the public. And what this bill does is allow prosecutors to screw them. And they deserve it, as far as I'm concerned. I guess I got a little carried away.
Sounds like a force speech, it does.
So, are there any other comments from members of the committee?
Looks like he's ready.
All right, we'll take a vote on the motion, which is to send the floor to the bill to the floor with a due pass as amended.
Representative Bowman?
No.
Representative Gianelli?
Yes.
Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Representative Simmons?
Aye.
Representative Sinclair?
Aye.
Vice Chair Pozanski?
No.
Chair Manning?
Yes. The motion carries. The bill is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do I have a volunteer for a carrier?
Strobeck.
Representative Strobeck will carry the bill. Thank you very much. This concludes the work session on House Bill 3287. Next up. House Bill 3377. We'll move into public hearing on House Bill 3377. Counsel, would you please summarize the measure?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. First, for the members' information, this bill does have a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee. What this bill does is allows for the issuance of revenue bonds in order to finance prison work programs and allows the State Treasurer, at the request of the Prison Industry Boards, which I abbreviated as PIB in my written summary, to do that, and then allows for those monies, which are income generated from prison work, to be pledged for the payment of those revenue bonds. The proceeds are used for implementing, maintaining, and developing prison work programs, as well as paying any bond-related costs which may arise.
Thank you. Chuck Smith, Oregon State Treasury. Come on up. And good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Morning. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Raleigh Wisbrock, and I'll begin the testimony. We'll be
good
brief.
Good morning.
We'd like to address a couple policy issues in the bill as written and work with the committee to strengthen the a couple points that will increase or support the credit quality of the bonds as they will be sold. And it's very important to us to maintain the credit worthiness of any debt that's issued under the name of the State of Oregon. It's been the policy of every treasurer that, as far back as I can recall, that we would issue debt that is investment grade and maintains a very high standard. We've done that. It's been the policy of the legislature also to support it. We have some recommendations to make in that line. Beyond what I've, outside of the meeting, talked to the chair about, if the source of revenue for support of the bonds and beyond the revenues from prison industries is important, and Chuck will go into that in some detail, but if lottery perhaps, or whatever the source of revenue, but if lottery is chosen as a source of backup for this measure, then we would have to also include Senate Bill 200 as a standard for the credit quality of the lottery support, and just would like to get that on the record, and we can work with you on that. Our suggestions are not too dramatic, just more detail-oriented. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Smith, who's the head of the Debt Management Division for the Treasury.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chuck Smith, and I'm Director of Debt Management Division at the Oregon State Treasury. This morning, I'd just like to direct my comments to four factors respecting House Bill 3377, and those four factors are the need for bond credit enhancement, the need for a thorough tax analysis respecting the bond's tax status, the need for identifying an agency to provide administrative support on an ongoing basis throughout the life of the bonds, and the need for statutory authorization to sell the bonds during the 1999-2001 biennium. I guess the first one would be the most critical need, and that is the need for credit enhancement. House Bill 3377 really envisions sort of a startup industry that would receive its capital, including working capital, through the sale of bonds, without having a good track record or any track record, and investors would be extraordinarily reluctant to buy such kind of securities. One way to solve this dilemma would be to modify the credit, and that is replace the credit of the underlying revenues flowing from the work program, replace it with another type of credit that from another state resource. And that may be, for instance, as Raleigh mentioned, replace it with lottery bonds. There's a separate independent credit that is already proven in the marketplace that could be used. Senate Bill 200 would be needed with the lottery bonds to ensure that they were uniformly issued along with all the other proposed lottery bond kind of uses during this legislative session. So that would be one area. Another one might be replace the credit or modify the credit through an appropriation-style revenue bond. This would be a bond that has its backing as a biennial appropriation from the legislature to pay debt service on the bonds when they became due. There would be other things that potentially you could do from a credit modification point of view. But the fact is, the way the bonds are envisioned here under 3377, they really wouldn't be acceptable into the marketplace. A second area that needs to take, some work on in this particular bill would be a thorough tax analysis respecting the state's bonds here. Almost all of the bonds the state sells are tax exempt, and by being tax exempt, the state realizes significant interest savings. We can sell bonds that are exempt from federal and state income tax, and therefore the bonds command a much lower interest rates than bonds that would be subject to, for instance, federal income tax. By doing so, it's an important subsidy to state and state programs. So this needs to be thoroughly analyzed, and that the analysis is, I guess, occasioned here by the use of the proceeds. That's really the key to your tax analysis. How are the proceeds used, and how will the bonds be repaid? And the bill envisions use of proceeds for working capital, including wages and salaries, materials. It includes contracts and partnerships with private parties and so forth. So we have a number of tax issues that are involved here that need some careful analysis. The third area I'd like to just talk about is need to identify an agency to provide ongoing administrative support. Each bond program in the state has an agency involved along with the Oregon State Treasury that provides ongoing administrative support, arbitrage calculations, rebates, et cetera, over the life of the issue. So when you select that kind of agency, you're really looking at an agency that's going to be in place working on this bond issue from an administrative point of view for the next 20 years. And finally, the need for statutory authorization. The legislature passes every 2 years what we call a bonding bill. And the bonding bill is simply a bill that allows or actually permits the issuance of every single bond in the state of Oregon. So you need either be in the bonding bill to issue bonds, or in the enabling legislation, you need to create an exception to the bonding bill so that you have authority to issue such bonds during the 99-2001 biennium. So those are four areas that we think that perhaps the committee would like to take a look at under House Bill 3377. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions respecting the bonding side of this.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. I'd mentioned that I would hope that you'll have some discussions with the Department of Corrections as to how they want to move with this, because that is really what the intent of this bill was, is to implement a desire by the Department of Corrections to have some authority to proceed with their prison industry programs and to have bonding authority for some of those programs. So I'd appreciate it if you could have a conversation with Dave Cook and the folks who run the prison industries program, including Mr. Tafe and perhaps Ben DeHaan, Mike Tafe and Ben DeHaan. This is not an official administration bill, but this came out of conversations with corrections about what they would like to do to strengthen their programs. And we'd be happy to develop amendments that meet their needs and your needs. Representative Bowman, did you have a question?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I wanted to go back to the issue of backing these bonds with lottery. I think that was your suggestion when you were talking, that there was a possibility that we would back the bond repayment with lottery bonds. Is that what?
I heard. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, actually, what I was suggesting is the lottery could be considered to be used to back the bonds. What the idea here is to replace the underlying credit that these new lottery bonds, which are essentially a startup and rather untried program, replace that credit with something that's established in the marketplace, for instance, lottery-backed revenue bonds.
In effect, the lottery serves, our lottery proceeds serves as a guarantor on the bond, that there's a guaranteed source of income if the agency can't come up with the resources to meet its obligations.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, lottery would not have to be the only source of support. As Mr. Smith was suggesting, we could also do an appropriation credit. There are a number of different ways we can do it. I think that is the direction of the chair of the committee, what you want to establish there. The other detail, we certainly can work with Dave and the corrections people, and we'll come up with some guidelines there. You give us direction on what you think your credit should be, and I think we can move forward on it.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up.
Sure.
I would also, I know I've had this conversation with a couple of you from the treasurer's office. Ultimately, I would hope that the state would be weaning itself off of lottery dollars, and every time the word lottery bonds pop up, it just makes me crazed, because then again, we're set for the next 10 years, we're set for the next 20 years. And so I would hope that as you are evaluating the effectiveness of going into debt to fund prison work programs, that we are also evaluating what we're doing to the state in the long term about taking that kind of move. I in my opinion, I just can't, with all due respect to the chair, since his name is a chief sponsor on this bill, I think we're going down the slope that we'll never, ever, ever get out of if we continue to see lottery bonding as the savior for necessary state programs, and we don't have the desire to figure out how to fix the tax system. Lottery bonds isn't going to do it. But that wasn't a question. Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you for coming this morning. We appreciate your testimony. We'll call up Mary Botkin. And by the way, we'll try to have a work session next week if we're able to work out the details, since next week is work session week, it looks like. Representative Prasansky, did you have a question?
No question.
No.
Well, Ms. Botkin is coming up. I know that this has a referral to revenue. I guess I'm not sure if the chair maybe can give us some direction as to what these amendments might be. It seems to me that this is a discussion that revenue should be having as compared to being more germane to their broader spoke than what we might be doing.
We do have a referral.
Yes, we do, Mr. Chairman.
What we could do is go ahead and refer it to revenue and let them deal with the technical side, if you're comfortable with that.
I think that would be the best way, because instead of us hearing it, revenue's going to have to hear it too, and it seems like they've had their plate full with these type of issues. If it's not inappropriate, maybe that's what we should do.
I think that's a good suggestion, Mr. Prasansky. Ms. Botkin, do you want to say you're here in support of this?
I just think that this is probably as good a way to fund prison industries as any that we've come up with. As you know, Mr. Chair, prison industries is a critical part of the security program inside our institutions, and anything that we can do to enhance their funding base is good. You know, I should always have a red flag go up whenever they're talking about bonding. It is an area of the law that you have to be really focused on, and there's a lot of expertise required to work on it. I just came in to say that I think it's a great idea to think about doing some bonds to expand our prison industries program. And I think the only other thing that I was going to say, and I'm not sure it's appropriate in this bill, and I'll follow it down to revenue, is as long as we're amending it, we probably ought to think about the non-compete language.
Well, we already
have
that developing
about
an H.G.R. 82,
right,
which will come up Wednesday.
Right. So that was the only thing that I was going to say, is that we might want to think about the non-compete language. And until we get changed the Constitution, I guess we really can't put it into a bill, though, can we?
Nope.
So, anyway, that's all I wanted to say. Good idea. I'll follow it down to revenue.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, is there anyone else that wants to testify in House Bill 3377? Seeing no one else, this concludes the public hearing. We'll move into work session on House Bill 3377. Representative Prasansky.
Mr. Chair, I would make a motion to move House Bill 3377 to the Revenue Committee with a favorable position from this committee to continue work on it.
All right. Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Is there any discussion? All right. The motion is to send House Bill 3377 to the Revenue Committee. Technically, that means with a due pass, but with an understanding technical changes are needed. Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the motion carries. House Bill 3377 is sent to the Committee on Revenue. Thank you. This concludes the work session on House Bill 3377. We'll next move to House Bill 3378 and move into public hearing on House Bill 3378. And I'll ask Council to summarize the measure, although I'll mention that it is being dramatically rewritten.
Mr. Chairman, what this bill has to do with, excuse me, is cemeteries, and there are a few different components to this bill. The first thing that this bill does is requires any organization which owns or controls a cemetery to register the cemetery with the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board. Two classes of cemeteries are established, that is active and inactive, and very briefly, the main difference between the two is if the cemetery in the last 5 years has had 25 or more internments.
No interns.
Never returned.
My staff would be very dismayed to find out about that. Then it would be active as opposed to inactive. And among other provisions, there are some general fund monies appropriated for 2.5 full-time staff positions. The crime part of this bill has to do with the current crime of abusive memorial to the dead. It is currently a Class A misdemeanor, and there is only one degree of that crime. This separates that crime into two, to a memorial on the dead in the first degree, which is a Class C felony, and abuse of memorial to the dead as a Class A misdemeanor. And, Mr. Chairman, I can, but I don't have to. Would you like me to explain the difference between those two?
I can. Well, you go ahead.
Certainly. Under current law, a person commits this crime if they destroy, mutilate, deface, injure, or remove any tomb, monument, gravestone, anything like that, or a fence, railing, anything protecting any one of those tombs or memorials, or any such tree, shrub, or plant that is in that cemetery. What this bill would do is to say that if a person destroys, mutilates, defaces, injures, or removes the tomb, the monument, gravestone, or the other actual structure that is designed as a memorial to the dead, then that becomes a Class C felony. However, the destruction to the fence, railing, the curb, or anything that is used as a protection for those memorials, or, for example, the shrub or the tree or the bush, defacing or destroying that would remain a Class A misdemeanor.
And what I'll explain is the Dash 1 amendments are what reflect what the council just described. This reflects Senate Bill 405A engrossed, which passed the Senate last session and reflected considerable workup, where a breakdown was made, or a distinction was made, between somebody who just messes up a cemetery overall, as opposed to somebody who actually destroys, mutilates, defaces, injures, or removes the grave marker or the actual structure of the grave, trying to draw distinctions between those and toughening the sanctions for those who actually go after the marker or the structure of the grave itself, as opposed to the grounds. And there will be a testimony available to us, I'm sure, as to the reason for this. There's also a concern with the language about who has the right to control grave sites in terms of what's done to the grave sites. And again, the Dash 1 amendments are, as I understand it, precisely what was in Senate Bill 405A in Gross last session. Representative Przanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if the Chair, or maybe we'll hear this to whoever's going to be testifying, if they could tell us about the portion of the bill, which is still in the bill itself, 3378, regarding the reason for setting up active and inactive cemeteries. And it sounds like it's every 5 years you report so you can come in and out. I'm wondering what the benefits are and why that's being proposed.
And in fact, we're going to we had hoped to have the comprehensive rewrite available this morning. Apparently, it's not yet arrived. There is a rewrite of this bill, which was sent to Legislative Council the week before last, to change the because meeting with the concerned folks involved, this is not going into work session today because there's a considerable rewrite of the bill, and I was hoping to have the amendments, if not by Friday, by this morning, to distribute them to the folks involved. Instead, what I'll ask is for folks to spend a few minutes coming up and testifying generally about the concepts behind the bill, and then we'll try to get them to work out the details before we go into a work session. So with that, I'll invite Gene Robinson to come forward. She is the chair of the Pioneer Cemetery Commission. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chairman Mannix, committee members. My name is Jeannie Robinson, and I am chair of the Pioneer Cemetery Commission, and I'm also executive director of the Oregon Historic Cemeteries Association. Did you want me to talk about abuse to memorials of the dead?
If you would, and also generally about the ideas behind the original bill, which is going to be considerably modified once we get this thing cleaned up.
Well, I'll start with abuse to memorials of the dead, if I may. The Pioneer Cemetery Commission worked exclusively on this during the last session. Our hopes were to improve the current legislation, which was the result of some work done by the Cemetery Association of Oregon. It's a very good bill. However, it had a couple of loopholes that we really wanted to see addressed.
You're talking about the old law.
The old law, yes, ORS 166076, which... this is amending that section. What we wanted to do particularly was in subsection 3, where the current legislation is such that it allows some people not to follow this law if they are the owner of a cemetery. And the intention, as we discovered in talking with the folks at the Cemetery Association of Oregon, was this would allow an operating cemetery to maintain the graveyard. They would be able to remove a stone that might be damaged so that they could get it repaired. What we feared is that this could also be read by a farmer who might have a single gravesite on his property that, well, I'm exempt from this. I can remove this gravestone. So our intent was to add the wording that states that, yes, this does not apply as long as the person's actions have the effect of maintaining, protecting, or improving the tomb, monument, gravestone, or other structure. We also wanted to be sure to enter into this some legislation regarding the buying of cemetery objects. The former legislation talks about that it was inappropriate to remove, but this talks about it's also, if you know that a gravestone or an urn, statue, picture has come from a gravestone, you've either hired somebody to remove it so that you can sell it, that this also is a crime that we would like to see these people also be prosecuted for. This has been a very severe problem in certain parts of the country. You may have heard things in the paper lately regarding some of the cemetery objects out of the New Orleans cemeteries that have come up for sale in very fashionable antique dealers in Los Angeles. This is moving our way, and we would like to see that that's prevented.
Graveyard raiders is what we're dealing with here. And there's we'll be able to discuss further. You do have a stratification here of Class C felony for the worst offenses and Class A misdemeanor for the lesser offenses. The concern we may have is if someone simply goes into a cemetery and is acting inappropriately, that's not involved here. They have to be actually destroying cemetery property to be effective.
Sure.
Yes.
Do we have the impact statement on this, fiscal impacts, that requires 2.5 new FTE out of the general fund?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Censori, we do not, and I actually wondered why we didn't. I suspect the reason is because there are some pending amendments.
The change in this bill will also, and I should advise some of the folks that are here, the idea is to shift the thrust entirely. We have a separate bill which moves the Pioneer Cemetery Commission under the Parks Department. It's not assigned to us, but we don't know what's going to happen with that bill, but the rewrite of this bill will move the... And there's several things. Because it'll be under the Parks Department, it actually should be set up as an advisory committee rather than as the label is commission right now, that there'd be an advisory committee for Pioneer Cemeteries under Parks, that and there probably will be an elimination of FTE that is nothing specific, just allow Parks as part of its administration to administer as the Department of Administrative Services has done, so that you keep the fiscal impact down. Then it's up to Parks to decide within its general budgetary process to go to Ways and Means to get funding for any special cemetery projects there would be no substantive provisions in the bill when it's rewritten.
So the amendments will drop the requirement for the FTE out?
Yes. So that this bill itself, the substantive bill, will not have to go to Ways and Means.
Makes me happy as a plan.
Would it also drop the requirement for the statewide survey of cemeteries?
Yes, it will. It will allow it, but it will not require it. And again, I haven't even seen the rewrite myself.
Okay.
I just talked to legislative council. It was based on feedback from the commission and from others about what ought to go in it. Even the structure of how cemeteries are regulated, we're trying to not impinge on the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board's job, which is really a separate job about what I'll call regulation of commercial activities involving cemeteries, and try to differentiate that. And I know these are not issues that we normally deal with in this committee. It seems to be fairly convenient that the bill has come here. I'm going to ask the folks involved to come up with the rewrite, and when we have a work session, when they see the rewrite, we can talk specifically about how it will work. But we'll be trying to remove any Ways and Means implications or any directives to carry out projects that cost money, so that can be left to the budgetary process. President Hanson.
Quick statement or concern that possibly somebody could deal with during the rewrite. I'm concerned with either Pioneer Cemetery, an inactive cemetery, and we've had a lot in Multnomah County, and they've got some real problems, not just with funding the ones that Multnomah County has inherited, that we managed to do a lateral arabesque to Metro. But then there are some small cemeteries that aren't in Multnomah County that have one or two people that are struggling valiantly to either maintain them or just keep them functioning at all, and it's a real struggle for them. My concern would be in the language, maintaining, protecting, or improving the tomb, monument, gravestone, or other structure, that they're just that if there's a safety hazard of a gravestone that might be a hazard to somebody, and the maintenance people would feel they have to take it down for a safety concern, but in effect they don't have money to repair it or restructure it. I would hate to see them covered by this. That I'm wondering if for safety reasons there needs.
I think
in effect they're doing the right thing, but they are maybe destroying the stone for good reasons.
Well, what we should do is ask the proponents of the amendment to consider that. What do you do about a safety situation where it's considered unsafe, and you have to take some steps to remove it because it's unsafe, perhaps with the intention of replacing it with something else at some point? So let me leave that with you, but did you want to discuss other elements of the issues, or should we leave it at that for now?
Thank you, Representative Mannix. I believe we should probably leave it for now. There's much more to discuss as it gets amended.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
What are the current laws regarding vandals who go in after Memorial Day and stealing flowers and such out of a cemetery?
It is a Class A misdemeanor. And by the way, that's another issue we may not want to move up to a Class C felony except for people that are buying stolen property from cemeteries. The concern may be, and it's inappropriate, but if some teenagers in some hijinks topple a headstone, it's a very serious act. Well, Class A misdemeanor is a very serious act. Class C felony really moves you up. We may want to think about what I'll call the commercialization of activity involving stolen products rather than as a Class C felony, and that is those who are buying and selling as opposed to the actual vandalism, which Class A misdemeanor pretty much handles. Part of this bill does address buying and selling and transporting, and that might be the area that should be the Class C felony. I think I'm discerning that's where you're getting. What you're getting at. All right, and Jeannie Robinson, thank you for coming this morning. I'm sorry we had to kind of jump through this. I expect we should see that LC draft today, and I'll get it to you immediately. And I apologize that we didn't have it sooner. We'll plan on a work session next week to move this bill once everyone's had a chance to see the LC draft, revamp it, and check with committee members about the language.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lucinda Potter. Good morning, welcome, and thank you for your patience and waiting for a chance to come up.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Mannix, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lucinda Potter, Executive Director of the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board. I'd like to just defer any comments until we see the LC, so thank you.
thank you, and I apologize that you had to wait that long for that brief appearance.
That's okay, thanks.
Is there anyone else that wants to testify on House Bill 3378? Seeing no one up, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3378. Colleagues, the last item up today is, before we get into it, I'll mention, there will probably be a series of bills that are set for quick hearing. There will be some short hearings, which are 10-minute hearings, and that's designed to give folks a chance to brief us on the bills. For instance, President Bowman has a memorial that she wants to make a presentation on. As opposed to that, there will also be probably Wednesday or Friday, 15 or 20 bills, which will simply be tapped in and tapped out. And you'll see that on the agenda. We'll try to specify the ones for 10 minutes. The tap in, tap out are bills with handy relating clauses, which may serve as cargo carriers, and we just want to have had a quick hearing. And so when you see a batch of those, don't freak out. President Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, I guess one other thing I hope that we might be able to do is take whatever precautions or giving notice to people that may be wanting to give testimony that these are very limited for a specific purpose of retaining the ability to work on them in the future. I know that there is some individuals that may want to be giving testimony, and some of them, I know the chair's intent is not to get bogged down, but just to make sure we preserve them for future use if necessary.
Yes, and in fact, what we'll do is on some, the pitch can be made. It'll show that they're 10-minute settings. Come in, make the pitch for the bill. The others are not, we'll put out a notice saying these are being set for hearing simply for purposes of convening the hearing and no significant testimony is anticipated or something like that. All right. Finally,
I drive 300 miles for that kind of eater.
That would be unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that happen, too. We'll move into work session on House Bill 3265. Counsel?
Mr. Chairman, we have heard this bill before. In fact, we heard it on the 12th last week, and the committee requested a fairly small amendment. Brad Swank had testified that there was a minor glitch, and what the Dash 1 amendments do is to clarify that language in this bill, which does clarify the criminal jurisdiction and the civil jurisdiction of Justice Court, does not supersede another statute which specifically allows Justice Courts to enter into agreements to provide justice services to cities for enforcing city ordinances and charter provisions.
And I see a couple of folks here. I'll make sure there's no one here that needs to testify or wants to appear during work session. I don't see anybody waving at me. We're in work session. Yes. Representative Brzezinski is okay, I think, since it's his bill. Representative Brzezinski, do you have a motion on this Dash 1 amendment?
Yes, I do. I just want to make sure it puts the...
According to my notes, the Dash 1 amendment deals with the issue that came up during the testimony, and I double-checked that last night, so...
Mr. Chair, the only thing I'm looking at is at the amendment itself. It says page 1, line 16, after the period, insert.
Yeah, what happened is, and I know in our notes we were going to change line 17, but what happens is they added this as a phrase at the beginning of the sentence rather than within a later part of the sentence.
Okay.
So it would read, except as provided in ORS 51037, a justice court does not have.
I understand. Okay. This, with that clarification, I will move the Dash 1s into the bill.
Representative Brzezinski moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3265. Discussion? Objection? Seeing no objection, the Dash 1 amendments are adopted. Representative Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 3265 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Discussion? Objection? Seeing no objection, the motion is adopted. House Bill 3265 is sent to the floor with a due pass. Representative Brzezinski, will you be the carrier?
Yes, sir.
Representative Brzezinski will carry. Seeing that for the business, we are adjourned. Thank you all.
Didn't see the comma after the ORS number.